So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's August 10th, 2016. And I want to continue with the thread that we're on, which has to do with dealing with or practicing with the feeling tones of experience, the sense of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. That's what the Buddha called or has been translated as the feeling tones of experience. Not about emotion per se, but what in psychology today would be called the hedonic tones or valence of experience. Is it, unpleasant, spit it out? Is it pleasant, chew and swallow? Is it neutral, look for something tasty? Kind of the basics. And to that, as you probably know if you've been here before, I would add and emphasize the social dimension of life, where we're in a field of relatedness. Having to do with our fundamental needs for connection. So in the applications of mindfulness that the Buddha said was the direct path to awakening, sometimes translated as the one-way path to awakening. In terms of the four major places to be mindful of for awakening, and along the way, suffering less and harming less, one of the four is literally this matter of the hedonic tone, the feeling tone of everyday experience. Because it's one thing to feel the unpleasant without going to war with it or running from it or freezing around it. It's another thing to feel the pleasant without getting addicted to it, without tipping into wanting more, mine, and so forth. And it's also something to feel related to others or disconnected from others without having it pierce you to the core, without losing your fundamental inner peace and equilibrium. So this matter of dealing with the hedonic tones or feeling tones of experience is very fundamental to practice. It's also very fundamental to psychology. We evolved to experience certain things as unpleasant, others as pleasant, many as neutral, I'd argue as well, many things as heartfelt, for lack of a better word, for the sense of relatedness. We evolved to feel those, and they're natural triggers to keep us as animals alive. But if we lose our balance, if we lose our footing, we end up getting a lot more upset than we need to. We end up creating a lot more harms with others than we need to. So practicing with mindful awareness in real time, or retrospectively sometimes, thinking about what actually happened, being able to do that in real time installs a kind of inner shock absorber. So we are able, as it is said, to walk evenly over uneven ground. There's a Tibetan teacher, Shantideva, who said that the world is covered with sharp stones and thorns. What shall we do? We could cover the world with leather, or we could put on a pair of shoes. So that's what this section of our exploration of mindfulness is about, this year is about, practicing with the hedonic tones of experience. And tonight I want to talk about practicing with what's unpleasant applied to our third major need, our need for connecting to others. In previous talks, which you can get on my website, I've explored how to practice with unpleasant hedonic tones related to our second major need for satisfaction. In other words, how do we practice with frustration or disappointment or not be so deluded by the inner ad agency that's always trying to sell us on chasing something new? And before that, I talked about dealing with the hedonic tone related to threats to safety, particularly around experiences of anger or fear or helplessness, how to practice with that. Tonight, I want to talk about relationships. And as usual, rattle on for a while and then see what you have to say about it. Okay? So I want to start with a story that I believe is fundamentally true. I might have some of the details wrong. It's kind of an entry into this topic. You may know the story. It's about Nelson Mandela, an activist, freedom fighter in South Africa, who was jailed by the South African apartheid, white-dominated government. He was jailed for some amazing number of years, I think around 27, if I remember correctly. And he was moved from prison to prison. And of course, the authorities wanted to mistreat him as much as they could, to make him crack, to harm him, his vengeance and so forth. So they put him to hard labor with other prisoners, really, really tough, grueling conditions. And Mandela himself, when he was writing about that time, as you know, he was eventually released and eventually became president, actually, of a democratically elected, with everybody more or less having access to being involved, the democratically elected president of South Africa. When he was in prison, he writes that perhaps the worst time for him was when he felt like he could no longer, he was separated from anyone to love. He had no one to love. That was his greatest hurt. It wasn't being stuck in solitary confinement or breaking big rocks into little rocks and little rocks into gravel and gravel into sand. It was being unable to offer his love, which speaks, of course, to one of the great wounds, the inability to offer the contribution that we really do want to make, including lovingness toward other people. So in his, after going through a great deal of despair about this, he realized that he could love his jailers. He could love his guards. He could love the people who were jabbing him with sticks. He could love with the authorities that were withholding food or medicine from other prisoners, or as well as himself. He could love them. It didn't mean giving up his views of justice or continuing in his own way as best he could to be the fundamental leader of the resistance movement. But at least he could open his own heart. And that's what he did. And as the story goes, he just started loving his jailers. After a while, they couldn't beat him up anymore. So they got replaced with new jailers. But they couldn't beat him up after a while. And he just kept loving. He kept, that's what he could do. And also, apparently true story, some of his former jailers and guards became front and center in his own security detail, and ended up sitting in the front row at his own inauguration. That's kind of a context here. So with that as kind of a pretty big deal sort of story, I want to tell a much smaller deal story about myself that relates to five questions that I want to offer that might be useful when you're dealing with the sense of hurt or embarrassment, or resentment, right? Unpleasant feeling tones in the social sphere. Feeling mistreated, feeling lonely. But especially I want to talk about when something has happened to us. So these are the five questions. And to go into them, I want to tell a little story, which is that when our kids were young, we first rented and then scraping it together, with help from my parents, we ended up buying a house in Terra Linda. This was 20 plus years ago. And we have neighbors across the street and on either side, and kind of on open space on the other side. And our neighbor on one side was an older man who was living alone. He was a retired school teacher and quite an odd character. One of the issues we had when we first moved in were rats, and we couldn't understand why there were so many rats. But we then found out that he was putting out dried dog food at night to feed the local raccoons. There were millions of raccoons as well. But the rats were really happy about all that extra food. So there were various issues around that. Okay, so we made our peace with that. It was all fine, good neighbors. And then a tall eucalyptus in his backyard, in a windy, one windy night, fell into our backyard, crushing the fence between us, this old rickety wooden fence, and, you know, 50, 60 feet of eucalyptus just lying there in our backyard. What do we do? So we went through many steps with this process, and I want to kind of offer five questions for you to consider, and I want to illustrate them with my little story. And I suggest as well that you imagine someone in your life today that you have a grievance with. Could be active, could be your neighbor, could be maybe it's sort of like simmering in the background, like this ongoing sense of feeling let down by an intimate partner, a I mean, on any given day, you can sit across the dinner table or keep the peace, but there can be good in the relationship, but there are underlying grievances. Maybe it's a really hot issue. Maybe you can think back on experiences you've had, you know, when you were younger, that are still very much with you today. And of course, as I go through these five questions, it's not in any way to minimize anything that has happened, as I think you'll see in the very first question of all. So, okay, it will help to bring to mind something real for you. I encourage you not to go into the white-hot core of your personal trauma history. You know, don't be hijacked by it. First of all, do no harm and all the rest of that. But here we go. So for me, the first question is, what's happening here? What's happening? Can I slow it down? What's really happening? Inside myself, what's happening? Is there hurt? Is there anger? Is there feeling shocked? One of the very first things that happened for me with the tree was I was totally shocked because he wouldn't take it out of our backyard. He just wouldn't do it. Like, days went by, weeks went by, eventually months went by. I had a dead tree. We had a dead tree with young children, just whack, there in our backyard. What? Right? So what's happening inside yourself? What's happening here? Also, it can really help to look outside. What's really happening? What's actually happening here? How big a deal is this? How consequential? Over what time scale? What's actually happening here? And what else is happening here? Like, it didn't land on our roof. Right? On any given day, my wife and I and our two kids lived, you know, relatively well, especially compared to many people. That's all. They went to school. They did their homework some of the time. What else is happening? So that's the first question. What's happening here? Often in the moment, especially if it's hot in the moment, right there, the rubber meets the road. We kind of react. We don't see the whole picture, or we don't really see what's going on. So slow it down. What's happening here? Including whatever legitimate injustice is happening here. There was an injustice. He didn't. It wasn't like, oh, yeah, whatever, man. Or, oh, well, two sides to the story. Shape of the earth, both sides of the story. No. It was his tree, our yard. He's responsible. I don't want to go to war about it, but come on, man. Get your tree out of our yard, okay? So there was an injustice there, and being willing to see that injustice and claim it, and not, you know, out of some kind of excess of niceness, pity, what have you, not being willing to also see what's the truth. There's a saying, truth or harmony. And very often people will choose harmony over truth. Now, sometimes there's a place for that, you know? Daddy, is this the bestest picture in the world? You bet, sweetie, it's the best one in the world. There's a place for that, okay? On the other hand, you know, often we err on the side of harmony. And on any given day, we think, well, keep the peace, harmony. But we accumulate the cost of that over time. Eventually, we're going to need to choose truth over harmony. Why not choose earlier and not accumulate those costs over time? So that was the first question. What's happening here? Okay. The second question was, is it really about me? That was really useful. Because, of course, when it happens, you know, what a surprise, we take it personally because we're persons. It's personal. It's my backyard. I like my backyard. What's your tree doing in my sanctuary? It's my temple. I want to go outside and you're... I can't even walk around your tree, you know, and who knows what kind of rats are living in it. But anyway, you know, we tend to take it personally, you know, and in that often other experiences get stirred up. Like, how can you treat me like that? How can you treat us like that? Well, wait a second here, you know. And when we step back, though, is it really about me? You can see that sometimes the person has deliberately targeted you, or they are deliberately trying to mess with you, or other words, and including through not doing anything, you know, acts of omission, not just acts of commission, right? It is personal to some extent, sometimes. But around that, whatever is actually personal, and sometimes there's really nothing personal about it. You just happen to be there in the middle of their bad day. Right? One of the horrible things and one of the wonderful things about life is that we are usually just bit players in other people's dramas. Yeah. So for me, in that situation, and my wife, you know, when I talked about it, it's her view as well, there's a lot going on here. He was getting really old. On any given day, for him to mobilize around it, you know, you can just imagine an old man living alone. We knew a little bit of the backstory. There'd been a divorce. Kids, you know, never visited. The house was falling apart, actually. Yard never tended to, his own yard. You know, who knows what he did at night. There's a lot there. Money tight. He probably didn't want to get his homeowner's insurance involved. Who knew? But it was a bigger picture. It was part of a larger world. And also, it was, you know, the world altogether. Things happen. There are other bigger issues in the world. You know, is it? You realize that, you know, whatever's happening here locally is part of a vast network of events. You know, like there's this local wave in the ocean of causes, as it were. Okay, this wave matters. The tree needed to go. But what's the bigger picture? Is it really about me? Okay. The third question that, you know, was very useful for me, and I kind of want to offer it now, is what are your real needs? What are my real needs here? All right. So in the need set would be like, yeah, you should apologize, or you should admit that you did us wrong by letting weeks and months go by and promising to do something but never keeping your promises, right? I want you to admit fault. That seeking of admission of fault in another, good luck with that. You know how you feel when people wanted you to admit fault, you know. Maybe it goes both ways. So anyway, when I say you, I include myself in this. So what are our real needs? What are our material needs? What are our substantive needs? I mean, really, we needed to restore the fence. Really, we needed to get the tree out of our yard. You know, those are legitimate needs. But really, it was very secondary for him to admit fault. Also, I wanted to keep the peace with my neighbor. One of the, you know, the kind of nastiest quarrels are neighbor quarrels, because you're right on top of each other and it's very close. It's easy to kind of go there. As a detail, I think about that in terms of long-term relationships with in-laws, other family members, teenagers. It's the long game, you know, that really matters a lot. So that was the third question. You know, what are our actual needs? And I think about that a lot in different situations. I try to zero in on, okay, really, what are the outcomes here that I'm really going after? What's the prize I want to keep my eyes on? Whether it's in this wrangle with another person, or how we're going to operate as a family, or how to deal with, you know, Sam or Sue or whatever on the other side of my cubicle here that I'm kind of stuck with probably for at least a few more years. You know, what are my substantive, major, material, real needs, including my needs to not feel like a jerk myself, or my needs to not, you know, have this person invade my mind, right, and hijack me from the inside out. There's this, for me, really fundamental comment that, as best we can tell, the Buddha made, describing his own path, 7-year path, toward awakening. And he's talking about the later stages of that path. He basically says unpleasant experiences, unpleasant feeling tones, unpleasant experiences did arise for me. And by implication, pleasant experiences and heartfelt experiences arose for him as well. But here's the key phrase, here's the key distinction. They did not invade my mind and remain. Invade and remain. It's so psychological, isn't it? There's nothing supernatural, spooky about it. Invade and remain. That's the key distinction. So that was another real need I had. I didn't want to bear a grudge. You know the line from Alcoholics Anonymous? Resentment is like drinking poison and waiting for others to die. right? The Buddha's version of that is getting angry at others is like throwing hot coals with bare hands. Both people get burned. I didn't want to be burned myself. That was a real need as well. Also, a real need was to demonstrate to our children how to deal with injustice or provocation or attack. You know, how do you find that middle place where you're not, you know, tipping into napalm, you know, which apparently is some combination of glue and gasoline. You know, it sticks and burns, right? How do you not tip into that? But on the other hand, how do you not be a doormat or walk on eggshells or a marshmallow or what have you, pushed around? You know, how do you find that middle place where you can speak truth to power with, you know, a calm heart? Okay, that was the third question. What are our real needs here? Fourth question is, are they suffering too? That's a good one. Are they suffering too? And he was suffering too. He's no longer alive. He was suffering too. He was lonely. He was worried about money. It was a hassle for him to organize his mind to really deal with this thing. I bet there was some slippage as he was moving into his 80s along the way. He was suffering too. Other people, even people in your life, you know, I'm thinking of people actually, you know, in my life to a significant extent who've just, in my view, and that of many others who are neutral about it, whatever, you know, have mistreated me. And they're suffering too. It's easy to kind of see it at the local level, like the person, your intimate partner maybe, or your teenager, what have you, who's letting you down or not treating you with respect or not, you know, putting you front and foremost in their mind, etc. Whatever is true about how they're screwing up, stipulated for the record, are they suffering too? And you can then scale it even further up, thinking about, you know, people in companies or organizations who are creating policies that are institutionally in massive spreading ways, harming others, without in any way minimizing those harms or the importance of justice and so forth, are they suffering too, behind their gated walls, in their communities, with drivers and lots of money? You can even scale this all the way up. For many people, this is one of the hardest things to do, to look out at leaders in the world or politicians of various kinds, people running for office, and look at them and ask yourself, are they suffering too? And the trick, of course, is to be able to find that kind of compassion without losing sight of your own moral view. Both can be present in the mind. Are they suffering too? And I find for myself, when I bring that to mind, when I bring my wife to mind, when I'm getting aggrieved about something, or our kids to mind, why don't they call us? Or my neighbors, or other situations, or people who work with me or for me, or drop the ball, what have you, are they suffering too? That tends to soften the heart. In a weird way, it helps us feel less upset. And that's good for us, as well as being moral and benevolent. Are they suffering too? That's kind of where, if you look at the great spiritual traditions of the world, in my view, you know, at the kind of one of the very first entry-level questions, maybe the first and most fundamental of all, is this one. Are they suffering too? Is there suffering? That's where the Buddha started. There is suffering. They're suffering too. Right? And then the last question. What should I do? What should I do? What kind of action? Internal action. The Buddha talked about acts of thought, word, and deed. What should I do? Especially acts of intentional, volitional thought, word, or deed as being the most consequential for karma in this life, you know, in the accumulated effects of our personal causes, you know, inheriting the results, for better or worse, of our own actions. And who knew? Who knows? Maybe the Buddha knew, but and maybe others know today, but about other lives, whatever. But certainly in this life, you know, we accumulate the results of our own actions. So taking that into account, what should I do? What should I do? Right. With him, we graduated slowly but surely. And what should I do? I'll get some resources. Very often we enter into situations under-resourced. We don't have enough medical advice. We haven't had the good counsel of our friends. We're having that conversation without enough sleep or food in our belly. You know, we're not set up. So what should I do? I should, you know, resource myself up to the scale of the challenge. As a longtime therapist, the key issue that routinely walks in the door of my office is a situation where challenges exceed resources. We need to scale up resources to actually see the level of challenge clearly. This was a challenge that went way past just a kind of simple conversation with a neighbor. Hey, dude, could you get your 80-foot-long eucalyptus weighing 7 tons, probably at least, out of my backyard? No big. You know, we went way past that as the weeks and then months ticked by. So resourcing. Another thing is, how should you talk? The Buddha had a lot of very practical advice about wise speech, you know, particularly managing tone, being able to say the truth calmly and clearly with a healthy sense of entitlement for whatever the truth actually is and your right to say it, without tipping into what he called harsh tone, where, you know, it depends on the culture a little bit, but we all have probably some feeling for when we're really clearly going outside the lines. It's not just fiery, it's not just intense, it's not just grave and serious. It's something really problematic past that point. So what should you do? Also, in our case, we realized we needed to get legal authorities involved because it just wasn't happening. So I ended up talking with our insurance agent, like, what should we do? You know, I had no idea. And, you know, he wisely said, why don't you just write him a very polite, you know, this is someone who'd been down that road 100 times. It was my first time, right? And he said, you know, you don't want to burn your bridges with your neighbors. You want to try to keep the peace as best you can. But in a very polite and clear way, you can let him know that, you know, you've called your insurance company and my insurance company and its lawyers. That was a key word. Attorneys? The insurance company's attorneys. Not me. My fingerprints are not on the blade. You know, a lot of skillful parenting with teenagers is arranging for consequences that come through other pathways. Oh, wow. You know? But anyway, it was skillful. I wasn't lying. I was not doing that. But it was skillful. So anyway, so literally what happened, so I wrote him this letter, typed it up, and made it look nice. You know, it was typed, right? Letterhead, and left it in his mailbox, and it wasn't threatening. It was simply that I talked to my insurance company, and my insurance company was going to be contacting his insurance company, and could he let us know what that was, and you know, so the lawyers could talk with each other. The next day, there was a crew in his backyard, took that tree out, and it was gone the next day, just like that. Just like that. Wow, what a coincidence. You know? Now, not all stories end so happily, da-da. Sometimes people keep escalating and you get into a whole secondary process around domination and who's going to be the top dog and all the rest of that. But that was kind of the pathway. And I wanted to mention one last little detail under the general heading of, are they suffering too? And then I'll hear what you have to say about this and these 5 questions for practicing, working with when things are unpleasant in relationships, especially when truly you have been mistreated, you have been hurt, you do have cause for your grievance. I kept in mind that when our kids were, you know, young and trick-or-treating, you know, you notice as a parent how other people treat your kids. How they treat you, I don't know, sometimes it kind of washes on through in the sleep-deprived haze. But how they treat your kids, for better or worse, you remember that. And he treated our kids really well. You know, he really did. He gave them extra big candy bars for Halloween, which their mom sequestered. No, not all at once. You'll go crazy. But, you know, he was actually very kind to our kids. And I kept that in mind as, you know, is he suffering, under the heading of is he suffering too? And all that helped me act more wisely. Okay, so you got those questions. What's happening here? Is it really about me? What are my true needs? Are they suffering too? What should I do? Okay. Questions, comments, suggestions? Know any good lawyers? No, no, we're past that. Anyway, yeah, Tom.
These are great steps. Can you overlay, as you were going through these steps, how you felt?
You mean at the time?
Yeah.
Oh, sure, if you're interested, very briefly.
Yeah.
So what's happening here, I think of the Kubler-Ross stages of death and dying. Starts with shock, right? And then bargaining, and then I don't know what, anger, then despair, then, that's right, then tranquility and serenity or something. I kind of went through that. So the first one was, what's happening here, was that. And it was scary. I'm a nice guy, and also in my family growing up, because stuff gets stirred up in your history. What's happening here includes awareness of what's getting stirred up. Challenging authority figures, like an older man. Oh, who could that remind me of, maybe? Dad. That was very scary for me. So I was being in touch with that. Then in terms of, was it about me? I felt quite peaceful as I started reflecting. You know, it's a bigger picture. I have a practical problem. We have a practical problem sitting in our backyard. But as part of a larger picture, is it really about me? You know, that helped me feel better. And then real needs, that also was really good because, you know, the third question, because it took out all these secondary issues. You know, it's not about proving a point. It's not about getting him to apologize or remember admit fault. It's really about getting his damn tree out of my yard. Like, that's it, really, in a nutshell, you know? So I felt much calmer, and then it helped me zero in. What's the prize? Everything else is secondary. And it's so tempting. Often in interactions, people raise these secondary issues for many reasons, including it's a great way to knock you off focus on the primary issue, you know, where you just keep coming back to it again and again and again and stop you from doing that. So that. And then in terms of does he suffer too, that was actually a big breakthrough for me when I just remembered how nice he was to our kids at Halloween and how an old guy, you know, a lot of stuff happening in his life, loss of, you know, separated from partner, separated from kids, you know. His friends, the raccoons, which really meant the rats, you know. It's not a pretty picture, and so, you know, that. And then last, I took refuge, and that's the word in a sense. What am I going to do? I think oftentimes there's a saying, action binds anxiety. You know, skillful action, trying to zero in, okay, what's our plan, and then work our plan. You know, plan your work, work your plan. So, and that spanned several months, but yeah, thanks. Yeah. Yeah.
Rick, did you ever consider, like, just getting a chainsaw and getting it out of there yourself?
I did. No, that's a very good question. Exactly right. And what stopped me from doing that initially was, you know, like, you can do this, you can do a wise thing for bad reasons or good reasons, you know, or you could do a bad thing for good reasons, but, you know, like that. And initially, I just was like, you're to blame, it's your fault. If I do take care of this tree, it's going to be enabling your mistreatment of the world, you know. But it was like a lot of, but it wasn't like wisdom. It was like righteousness, you know, in me. That was part of it. And a little bit of it, too, is that this is the first and last house I've ever owned. You know, like, what do you do? Like, and I didn't own a chainsaw and, you know, all the rest of that. And so, and I, you know, I thought about making it happen, but also it was not cheap, and money was very tight for us, young kids. I think I was just out of grad school, just really starting. You know, it was like a few thousand bucks to deal with a tree potentially. Like, that was a lot, and so then I moved into a wiser place about why didn't I get a chainsaw or hire a crew myself. You know, Marin Arborist, my friend. But anyway, why not? And then it became really a matter of justice. It became more, I was more separated from it. It became more impersonal. And I was, frankly, in my view, if we, it's important to kind of, for me, language this artfully, if we just enable injustices, there's a time, I think, for realizing you're outnumbered, you're outgunned, you don't have the, you know what I mean? You're just not going to prevail here. They got you on this one. Darn. Move on, you know? There's a place for that. But if we can do something about injustice, in my moral view, I'm not saying you should think this way, but my personal moral view, in a sense, we have a duty to the whole There's a term in evolutionary sociobiology, altruistic punishment, where you stand up against freeloaders, even at a personal cost. And for me, there was something freeloading here. There was a kind of out of sight, out of mind, you know, like that. It was, no, that's morally wrong. I didn't want to enable that. So I ended up, you know, like I'm saying, I started with bad reasons for a wise action. You know, I just didn't, but then I acquired, over time, I think, good reasons for a wise action, which was to hold him responsible for what was truly his.
I agree with that. I just want to say, I used to run a tree company.
Oh, I need your card later, man. Did you? Okay. All right. That's interesting. Okay. A few others, and keep thinking about your own situation with your own grievances. Yeah, please.
Well, it reminds me of wise view.
Yeah.
And attachment to view.
Yeah.
And attachment to ritual. Huh? This happened, and you're supposed to do this. You're supposed to say that.
All right.
And you're not.
Yeah.
So I'm suffering, and I mean, it can really waylay the whole process.
Yeah.
But then, as you just said a minute ago, if you add, I'm attached, well, you didn't say this, but justice.
Yeah.
I'm doing this for justice. Well, that's an attachment to view and ritual.
Yeah.
So, you know, justice is different in different cultures, in different situations, and with different people.
Yeah.
So a lot going on there.
That's right. And as some of you may know, just to make it more general, you're talking about two of the four major targets of attachment leading to suffering, you know, that the Buddha talked about, view, right? And what he called then rites and rituals, maybe more updated, might be things like standards and routines, right? Yeah, want to keep going?
I have a little story related to that.
Yeah.
He called and asked me to do something for him, you know, on my birthday. Right? And then later when I saw him, I said, did you know that yesterday was my birthday? And he said, oh yeah, I did. And he kept on. And it was like, I got really annoyed. Because he was supposed to say, oh, I'm sorry, happy belated birthday.
Right.
I had an attachment to that ritual. And it wasn't until I actually identified that I could let it go. I thought, oh, that's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And wasn't on his mind anymore. I was suffering, ruminating about it.
Yeah.
So for me, being able to name what's going on can relieve the suffering and help me to move on to those other five questions.
Yeah. That's great. And you're speaking to a really big question and issue, right? Which is, how do we avoid the pitfalls of getting attached to our views, our opinions, our standards, you know, and all the rest of that? And also, how do we avoid getting attached to certain ways of acting in the world, rites and rituals, routines, and so forth? How do we steer clear of that? But on the other hand, don't become apathetic or just turning a blind eye to injustice or not standing up for our own legitimate needs in situations, right? That's a very big issue. It's a real common one. And you know, I hope to explore that with you all more and more. I find for myself, you know, a key distinction is, how do I feel inside? Am I getting tense, insistent? Is there a quality of strain about it? Those are often giveaways. And another clue for me, and so then if I notice that, I figure, okay, I'm, you know, even if what I'm thinking here is correct, and even if there is genuine justice here, I'm going at it in the wrong way. You know, be the change you seek, right? You know, world peace starts with inner peace, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I need to look to myself. Doesn't mean giving up around justice, but how do I look to myself? The other thing that I personally draw on that does help me here is I ask myself, what would I wish for a third party? Some sort of, like another person, like for example, if that tree and my neighbor had landed in somebody else's backyard. What if I were a judge sitting in, you know, a small claims court? Or what if I were an arbiter? Or what if it happened to be my friend, or I read about it as a story? What would I consider if I were, in other words, if I didn't have a stake in it? See what I mean? So that I'm not, you know, caught up in my own agenda and emotional reactions. If I didn't have a stake in it, what would be my view about appropriate conduct? And for example, for what it's worth, the first of the eight elements of the path that the Buddha laid out was wise view. And there's a place for having wise view. But as you, Christine, point out, you know, not getting identified with it or glued to it, you know, kind of holding it lightly. That is such a key, but it doesn't mean there's no place for a wise view, including moral standards and all the rest of that. Okay, maybe one last person? A nightmare scenario with your brother-in-law? You know, I don't know. Kids you never call? I don't know. You know. Maybe one last one. Okay, I'll just do this one, then we'll finish. I'm happy to talk with you as we end.
Yeah. Well, I'm intrigued because what happened to you is so objective, so pragmatic, versus a noisy neighbor or this guy with the feeding the wild animals, which attract, make pests for you. I'm kind of curious, how did that continue? And that's a much trickier, like, I want to feed the animals. That's very different than a tree in my yard.
Okay, sure. Well, you're talking about different situations.
Well, much harder to...
Yeah, deal with.
To deal with, because want to have the party. I want, you know, I'm making noise. Well, so what, you know?
Right. What do you do? And there are people sometimes in life, whatever reason, they've got you in the crosshairs and they are coming at you. And, you know, I've worked with people going through divorces where the wake-up call, that's the first question. What's happening here? The wake-up call was to realize that this person that they walked down the aisle with was no longer their friend and was going to keep coming at them until some more powerful forces, like a judge and the rule of law, even stop that person.
But even then, the acting out continues.
Sometimes it does. Exactly right. So I want to really, and let alone scaling it up. You know, what do you do when they really are bombing your village? You know, or not letting your kids go to school because they look different or something. What do you really do? Yeah, it's for real. You know, I've been pretty fortunate in my life. I have had situations where people clearly were coming at me. There are situations I'm dealing with now to some extent where that's actually the ongoing case. But I don't want to act like though my fairly comfortable life is at all scaled up, you know, to the lives of many others. I think, you know, for one, I guess maybe that's a huge topic. For me, there really is a place for take the actions you can, you know, to quote, you know the story of Nkosi Johnson? He's a South African boy born with HIV, about, I think, around 1990 or somewhere around there. In the middle of a lot of controversy, speaking of South Africa and Nelson Mandela, about AIDS, HIV, and so forth. And, you know, so he's born with HIV. His mother dies soon after. He himself dies when he was 12. I believe that's when he died. And he became, though, a national spokesperson for people with HIV, particularly children, the innocents, particularly, you know, I think everyone's innocent in terms of acquiring that kind of an illness, but conspicuously innocent as a kid. And anyway, he had a saying that essentially was, do all that you can in the place where you are with what you've been given in the time that you have. And whether that's, you know, Viktor Frankl talking about being in Auschwitz, you know, his only sanctuary was inside his own mind, or other people talking about terminal illnesses or terrible losses, you know, do all that you can in the place where you are with what you've been given in the time that you have. So for me, that's a really important thing, to know that at least I've done what I could. I mean, for me, that's important to know. Even if all I can do is stay quiet because I'm way outnumbered here, but inside my mind, I know what I think is really true, you know? I was talking with a therapist friend just the other day about a fateful choice many children face. And they make the understandable but wrong choice. And their fateful choice is, are they crazy or am I crazy? And the understandable but wrong choice often is to conclude that there's something wrong with me. Is there something wrong with them or is there something wrong with me? You know, in most cases, it was wrong with them. You know what I mean? So, but at least inside their own mind, what you can do is reclaim that or recover that and go, no, I was actually a little kid, you know? There was something off around me, but in me was good and pure and worthy of care and love that I didn't always get. for example. So I think that's one thing. And the other thing that I try to, I think, be aware of is, you know, to hold on to that refuge in your core, that even if they're, what, fill in the blank, even if they're doing this or that, terrible things happen. I was traveling in Greece on vacation some months ago, and I was just so struck by how much blood was in the ground, you know, in that area, the Mediterranean. And of course, obviously elsewhere in the world, there's a lot of blood in the ground, but for various reasons, it was just really hitting me. The brutality over the millennia, you know, so much blood in the ground. Like, bad things are happening, have happened, will happen. What do we do? But in our core, does it need to invade the mind and remain? Can we retain a fundamental freedom of view in our core, how we really see it, what we really value, you know? Can we retain access to a kind of timeless, spacious peacefulness? Can we keep love in our heart as Mandela did, no matter how badly we and others are being treated? You know, can we retain that sanctuary inside ourselves? You know, and I think that's another major thing we can do, even if, as you say, there's an ongoing, you know, injustice that's really coming at us. All right, how about we sit for a minute, finish up, let it resonate, and onward. Take good care. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.